Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Happy Nurses Week 2024. I was reading an article in Time magazine, and the headline reads, "Healthcare is one of the U.S.'s most violent fields." I think that's totally true. And on this episode of the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, I'm joined by my very special guest, Mel Cortez, and we're going to be talking about violence in the healthcare system, specifically hospitals, and most importantly, the emergency rooms. This is a very special episode. It's super interesting, and you won't want to miss it. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Rogue Nurse Media, 501c3, and The Well-Written Nurse, empowering nurses and patients to tell their stories. Welcome to the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast, Mel Cortez.
Hey, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited. I love the brand that you've built, and just your commitment to providing really quality content for the industry is really beneficial. So thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much. I love what you're doing as well. I think it's amazing.
Thank you. So tell us
about yourself.
I am a registered nurse. I got my bachelor's of science in nursing. I never wanted to be a nurse. My dad was an executive and he said, look, here's Forbes magazine's top up and coming 10 careers. This is the one you're going to pick, one of these, if you want to be, have help for with school. And so I said, okay, I guess I like biology. So I decided to be a nurse. I never really even knew another nurse growing up. A lot of people have these really great, like, compelling illness stories. I really don't. I ended up, like, barely passing nursing school. Like, I was just a terrible test taker, you know. I was
me too.
And so I, like, my nursing professors nowadays would be like, you gotta be kidding me, Mel's doing what? Like, that's not the same person we knew. But I ended up falling in love with critical care. And obviously, in order to be a really efficient critical care nurse in Baltimore, that's, like, you know, really well trained, classic. You know, we have a tremendous amount of experience and great thought leadership up there with Hopkins and University of Maryland. I was fortunate to work at Shock Trauma and be able to get a really rounded perspective. I was a travel nurse for 15 years and did the whole COVID ICU thing as well, and managed and did home health, hospice, anything that we could imagine. And my parents were really frustrated, right? Because they're like, oh my God, she just cannot keep a job. Like, she, why don't you just get somewhere, work, get your 401k, like, get your pension. And, I realized it was because I was supposed to be a consultant, right? I was supposed to be a thought leader in the space, because every place I went, I just seemed to care a lot more than everybody else. And I was like, but you guys could be so good. I mean, you could be so good. Look at this potential. Look at the opportunities that you have and the problems that we can solve. And, as a bedside nurse, that can be really frustrating. So I always tell people, like, if you feel like you're getting frustrated with the lack of the ability to cause systems change, figure out what the thing you can do in your sphere is, get really good at that thing, and then start telling people about it. And that's kind of really where I got my start, right? Was just that thought leadership and posting on LinkedIn, and then really having a student mindset and trying to develop a way that I could be impactful in the industry. If there were things that I wanted to see to be done differently, then what could I do as a nurse to do that? And that's kind of how I got into the business world.
I love that. I mean, I could relate to you as well. I had so many jobs, the same thing. Like, I love doing registry because it gave me so much freedom to do other stuff.
Right.
And my parents said the same thing to me, like, stay with one place. What's wrong with you? You know, and I even remember I worked at Children's Hospital as well for like 6 years, but I worked like per diem, like full time per diem. And I was also teaching, and it gave my parents street cred. They're like, oh, like, they were telling everybody where I worked.
And I'm just like, and when I quit, you know, they're like, what are we going to tell people now?
Right. My parents were the same way. They were just like, you're doing what now? We don't understand. Like, we have
yeah,
no idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, Mom, I met with the Institute of Homeland Security. And she's like, oh, is that, that sounds great. I think, are things going, but how are you going to pay your bills?
Right.
You know, I'm like, well, that's...
it'll happen. You're like, I'm in the fourth dimension and it'll I'm get like, to this the is third
different.
Dimension.
We're different up here, but okay. Don't worry
exactly,
about it.
Exactly. Exactly. I love it. And it's so true. You know, I spoke at an alumni panel for students a couple of weeks ago at UCLA. And that was one of the things. There were two other nurses who were also entrepreneurs on that panel. It almost seemed like everybody was an entrepreneur on that panel, which was great, you know, because you really want to get out of your box and figure out what you can do. I know there's a couple of nurses trying to make nursing STEM, like to get it into like noticed by technology. STEM.
Yeah.
Which I think it, yes. I mean, nurses are innovators.
Rebecca Love and Marion Leary. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things, like, you know, networking and relationship building, that's what nurses are great at, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where I've seen a tremendous amount of success over, you know, in this healthcare security industry. When I started my consulting company 4 years ago, I really wanted to create solutions to some of healthcare's most complex problems. I was like, look, if I can do it at the bedside or as a nurse manager or as a, you know, weekend supervising, house supervising nurse, like what is wrong with the system itself that can't figure this out? And I think it just is about being creative and about having some thought leadership in the area.
Yeah.
And being like, look, let's try something innovative. Let's try something different, because when you're solving problems, you're not really consulting. A consultant is somebody who innovates and creates a future solution that will help with profitability, legacy, and prevention, right? And those are the three things. And right now, going with what Florence Nightingale said 200 years ago, nothing can be done in the presence of, you know, fear. You really can't do anything when we're afraid. So that's
so
where I pivoted Cortex Gold, which GOLD stands for Guiding Organizational Leadership to Deliver, to innovative solutions that would really help secure our workforce, whether that's safety and security from a physical security standpoint, psychological, emotional, but also what can we do to retain our staff? Because ultimately, no one's going to listen to anything that we put forward. And that's what I tell nurses all the time. If you want to create meaningful change at the bedside or in your profession, figure out how it's going to save something money. Because ultimately, healthcare is a business. And we don't want to talk about it. You know, it's obviously, you know, there's that debate between whether it's, you know, something that's a human right or something that's a business. Well, we're not going to change that systemic outlook.
Until it's all about money, right?
Right. It's about
money. How can you save them money? It's very true.
It's the way that our system is designed. Unfortunately, might not be the best design, but while people like us are trying to look at it from a strategic approach, you know, when I meet with organizations like the AHA or the Institute of Homeland or whoever, we're having those big, long conversations about what we can do. But in the individual aspect, when we look at trying to make an impact in the profession, really it's being professional by understanding the constraints with which you do your job. So yeah, care is an important portion, but also so is resources and so is access and so is all the other things that have to do with a profitability of a business, because the more profitable that they can be, the better you're going to be able to perform your job, because we're going to have more revenue to funnel towards that. And a good friend of mine, a consultant that I work with, Dean Malpass, who's like really well known in the UK industry for social care and mental health care design, says like, profitability will always flow to quality, because you have to have quality in order to have a brand and a presence and all the things that these bigger organizations have developed. But because the healthcare system itself didn't change with the, you know, inflation rates and the cost of medication and all this other stuff, it's created kind of a systems collapse. And one of the things that ultimately a downhill representation of that is the violence, because it's coming from frustration. So it's coming from fear. It's coming from a lack of trust. It's coming from, you know, we had, depending on what your Facebook feed looked like, whether you believe vaccines were real. And now you've got all these nurses that are, you know, seen as, in some populations, as sheep, in other populations as heroes. So you kind of have to figure out who your demographic is. And one of the things that will save nurses is this ability to remain as a professional. And so professionalism training, you know, is really important. And that's like what you and I were talking about with these influencers and LinkedIn people that just leave bedside.
Yes.
They just go completely and they're like, oh, we're going to create bedside solutions, but we got to get you out of there. We can't let you work there anymore. Like, you guys, you know, it's terrible.
And that's not exactly the solution, because like we were talking about Lori Brown, and you listened to that episode with her, and we kind of talked about that a little bit. Like, one person's hell is another person's heaven in a workspace.
Also, if we all leave that have the experience to deal with a cantankerous patient, or to, you know, to have, if we all leave, who are we leaving our stuff with if we don't teach them? And then one day we're all going to be patients. Oh shit. Like, these people have to wipe my butt, and they like, I don't even want them near me. Well, you were the portion of that left, instead of saying, okay, I can keep one shift a month. And sort of, you know,
exactly.
Unit. It's nice to go to work. I find that, like, when I'm there at that, you know, shift that I can make, or the commitment that I can maintain, lots of nurses are coming over to me. Hey, Mel, oh my gosh, I had this last week. What do you think about this? Or, you know, the technique that you taught me 2 weeks ago to deal with this patient, I haven't had a violent event yet. You know, it's like that, right? Where we can test the content, but we're also being able to take that. And when I go sit in front of a boardroom, who in hospital structure, you've got like bedside staff and workforce, and then you've got your executive team, and then you have your board, your advisory board. And a lot of times these executives make an effort to hide the issues that are in the organization. Right. But the board is the board for a reason. They're experienced business folks. They have a lot of network connections. So like, if there's a problem that exists, usually the board could be able to help you figure it out, but you have to know how to analyze the problem and deal with it. And I think that's one of the things that I like to translate for the board, right? Is like, okay, this is the problem. This is why you're having this issue. Here are other problems that exist in your organization, because we've done some surveying or focus groups. And then let's see how we can coach the executive team to make really smart decisions. And oh, by the way, last week we did it over here and it worked out well, or this organization looks like you and had similar results, or we're working in collaboration with the Institute of Homeland Security to study some stuff. You might want to try this for your organization. So it's a really neat place to be, and be able to represent our voices from the bedside to that boardroom approach.
For sure. And I do the same thing. Like, I work like one or two days a week in clinic, and it's kind of the same thing. You know, I'm bringing a different perspective. I see like a whole different host of patients than the doctors see, you know, mostly the young teens, the kids that have questions about transgender issues, and stuff like
that.
And
I would be so love to talk about that offline, but I would be very interested to hear your experience with that. That's all I'll say about
sure. that. Sure. Yeah. And I, you know, that's a whole other topic, but I have been studying this whole trans issue from day one, since about 2015, when Caitlyn Jenner came out. And I've studied it not only through a healthcare perspective, but also through an art perspective, you know, and I've encountered many trans people, you know, living in Los Angeles. For a period of my time, I had a lot of gay friends, and I hung out in West Hollywood. That's all I actually did
That's
with my friends.
And it
was a very interesting time. You know, I am a straight woman, and it was interesting just to see. And there was no judgment at that time.
Yeah, as a nurse, you know, that's really why I like to in the opportunities that I've been able to kind of talk and speak with politicians and work in a little bit of that bipartisan legislative approach is really because I believe as a nurse, we're going to take care of you no matter what your beliefs
sure.
are.
Sure.
What,
of
you know,
course,
we
of
provide
course.
the same type of care. Cause I'll tell you what, a really sick trauma patient that just got ejected from a vehicle, it doesn't matter what any of that kind of stuff, demographics, we're still going to treat you the same way. Right. And I think like that really allows us to have a very unbiased approach and look at it from a perspective of true compassion and true empathy and care, but then allows us also to kind of help those organizations navigate through some of those difficult situations. Because like from a PR standpoint, a media standpoint, that's where a lot of decisions in healthcare is made, right? The largest budget that a healthcare organization has is its marketing budget. And
for
there's
sure.
a reason for that. There's a reason for that. And so like, if you can figure out how to retain and recruit, you know, whatever initiative you're working for from an emotional or social perspective, you know, that's where it becomes beneficial to a hospital to care enough to create system change.
I love that. I love so many things that you said. I had Joey Ferry on, and he's
I love
you know, Joey.
Joey. Yeah,
and one of the ways, because you brought up a great point, how can we save these hospitals money, and that'll open a door into an entrepreneurial venture. So with him, and you can go listen to that episode if you want on nursing innovation. He found out a way, like he did a research study for the hospital on linen costs and how much money they were spending on linen, because they were using the linen to pad the side rails. Mm-hmm. And right there, you know, he did a study for them, and it really launched his career into this whole entrepreneurial venture.
The research is important. And, you know, that's why we were really honored to be asked by the Institute to do some of their research and just help with, you know, other organizations like the International Association of Healthcare Safety and Security. They have a strong research connection. There's many opportunities to publish on something. And so those have been the opportunities where we've had to try to innovate to meet market need, to meet, you know, the need of our boards that we're consulting, and to answer some of those questions, because there just isn't enough evidence. There's not enough data in this space to give us any indications for true workplace violence prevention efforts. If we don't have a baseline data, how do we know we're doing well? Is there benchmarking opportunities? And then what are the things that we even want to benchmark to?
I love everything you're doing, because, and I want it, talk about how you got into workplace violence, because it is kind of a new frontier. Like, it's something that, you know, you always think about violence in the workplace. Oh, security, I'll just take care of it. But it's just gotten worse and worse and worse over the years. I mean, I don't know one nurse who has not suffered something. Like, I've been punched in the face.
Our surveys say like 98% of all healthcare workers have been a victim of violence, physical violence. And so the psychological portion, the threat of violence and the actual violence itself, there's really no delineation. In fact, the threat can be worse, because our mind can run away with the thought of what they would actually do to us. But second to an underground mine, an ER is the most dangerous place to work in the world right now.
Wow.
So that tells you the type of violence that these organizations are facing. And, you know, in the United States, we don't have strong legislation. And that's kind of the collaboration that I've been able to develop. So about 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, I was assaulted with a metal mop in an ER. So I was
a metal mop?
Yeah, I was a nursing supervisor of a small community ER in rural North Carolina. And I was weekend supervisor, and also had two critical care patients up front that I was managing, because we just didn't have experienced staff. It was like 30 patients, 40 patients, couple chest pains in the ED. Both the nurses on were less than 6 months of experience running charge.
Wow.
So I was down there helping, you know, and they had all these psych patients holding in the back. And this one guy just really got escalated, got a hold of a mop. Really, and as a result of me not being able to get past him, he was like 6'2", like 250 pounds, big dude, non-compliant to pain because he's in psychosis. So I had a patient in the front room on vasopressors. He was like maxed out on epinephrine, and his epi ran dry. and I couldn't change the bag. So he ended up arresting and dying. So he died as a result of that patient causing violence in the ER. And I kind of looked around. I was like, by the time the cops got there, it was 15 minutes. They didn't get the message it was a weapon. So they had been there all day with the guy using pain compliance techniques. And so I became, as the nursing supervisor, the target of their pain compliance techniques because wow. I let them do that to him while he was in the hospital. So after that, I was like, you know, this really shouldn't happen anymore. And I went on this like crusade of just meeting and learning from the top violence experts in the world. I didn't care what industry. I've talked to, you know, special forces guys. I've talked to, you know, executive protection. I went out and trained with Covered Six, and we had my co-founder went out and trained with them for months and learned how to be a level 4, you know, covert officer. And, you know, we trained with the best healthcare security folks, the best mental health resources from the UK. And so now the UK has some higher standards than what we have for us currently. And some of our legislation is shifting that way. So we're able to see the things that they did really well over there and the things they didn't do so well. So that's where we've created this network of collaborators that consult for us and with us for these organizations to create really innovative solutions and then do the research behind it.
So, so fascinating. I mean, I had a nurse on who was assaulted by a doctor.
Yep.
I mean, she was in the post-op, and I think she was a charge nurse, and this anesthesiologist was turning off the monitors, you know, the beeping monitors. And she told him, like she had told him before, and she noticed that this was a habit with him. And she went up to him and she's like, hey, I told you, you know, to stop doing that. And he just went and started choking her. And her medical director was like, oh, he said he'll never do it again. You know, because he barely let go. Did you hear about that
hospital? I think it was I don't want to say who it was because I don't know specifically, but there was a story that was just recently released. And then there was like a TikTok video from one of the nurses where the doctor had threatened to like literally bring a bomb and kill people.
Oh my God.
And like direct threats and had been like very violent to the staff. And they let him come back after he went to jail.
No,
he was arrested.
No,
he was arrested, posted bond. And then he came back to do his surgeries. I was like, what?
No, that is crazy.
And the hospital let it happen.
No.
And nobody, nothing happened. Like, oh, don't do that again, hospital. What the actual, I just can't. And like in the UK, places like that, that would never happen. Like they
it happens here so much. I mean, there was also Dr. Death, that whole podcast and show. Now I think it's like a series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the guy did the same thing, you know, and I had Charles Graber on the show, The Good Nurse, same thing. Yep. That guy in 9 years, like worked at tons of hospitals, killed tons of people. I even worked with the serial killer. You know, he was a respiratory therapist. And I was like, this guy is acting weird. And I was a new grad. Why do we have so many code blues? This guy is acting weird. Oh, he's so nice. Well, he killed like 50 people at two hospitals. And not only that, he was creating copycats. Okay. So the other respiratory therapists were doing the same thing, offing people to lessen their load. This is where we're going. You know, I'm just like, hello,
because there's so many system stressors that no one's really addressing, because I think it's that they just don't know what to do. And it's because you've got such a division between academia, administration and the bedside that there's not enough collaboration there, because there's been that middle channel of like middle managers and experienced nurses that used to advocate. We always had to advocate for a profession.
Right.
Like, I don't know where you guys forgot the idea of like nurse ratchet and these like nurses eat their young. They weren't only eating their young, but they were eating administration too for us.
Sure.
They were down there knocking on the door like, hello, like we need it. We've always had that position. You know, it's just that now I think we've, in the younger generations, they are not used to having to advocate. And when they try to advocate, it's through this like negative, like TikTok, social media, like this environment, like pure negativity. Don't go, don't be a nurse, be a realtor. Like, and it's like, okay, well, we did, and we're here now, and we have to do something to save our profession. So
exactly,
what's the thing that you can do? Like, you write, you do podcasts, you continue to work at the bedside when you can, you know, and give your skill set. Like, we're in a staffing crisis, so I don't have to work at the bedside anymore ever if I never wanted to again.
Exactly.
But I do, because I believe that the time that I'm there is valuable and can be helpful. And I'm good about keeping my fucking mouth shut about, you know, what's going on. You know, it's like, how can I be a positive representation for what's happening, and to coach and be a positive example when I'm there?
And these influencers, and that one particular that you posted, we won't say who it is. You posted on your LinkedIn. I was following her from the beginning.
And I had no idea who she really was. Yeah. I just happened to see it on my feed, and I was like, oh, this is.
Yeah, I was following her.
Problem.
Yeah, I was following her in the beginning because she was covering a trial, which people paid her. So nurses sent her money for her to go fly out, get a hotel, and go to this trial for 3 days. Right. I was like, Lord. That's what she said. That's her story. Who knows if it's true? So I started following her because of the trial, and I liked her commentary. But then she started getting very, very negative. And she just, I was just like, no, if you understand what's going on with the trial, and I talked about this with Lori Brown, it seemed a little bit shady, like this nurse was set up, you know, and it was like an administrative flaw. Sure, she made an error that killed someone, but still, you know. The way it was handled was terrible. Anyway, and then I just started noticing how negative she was and how nasty she was. She wasn't giving anybody.
Just one person in particular. I think
it's a lot.
It's a culture of like nurses who are negative, and then when they get to the bedside, they're negative there.
Yeah,
with each other, and they're rolling their eyes during report, and they're just like, and it's just this angsty approach. And I'm like, okay, like
that's not what it's supposed to be about.
Yeah, when we're precepting, I remember when you used to get like when you were precepted to a new job, there was a time where your preceptor would be like, hey, we're going to talk about the things that you didn't do great this week.
Right. Like, right.
And it was awkward. It was really awkward for a minute.
Well, of course, mommy, I'm sorry.
You know, they don't do that now. It's like they run to the nurse manager and say, they're just really not prioritizing their tasks. So then the new nurse gets pulled into the, and they're like, I had no idea. That's even worse. And they're all talking about each other. And it's just, that's the professionalism element that part of workplace violence prevention. Because if we are a cohesive unit, right, if we walk into the room, and even if Joe Blow over here is transient, right, he's homeless, he's got some mental health issues, he may have a substance abuse. If we're together and cohesive and we act like we're a team and we've got each other's backs, people aren't going to mess with us. Like, there's just a cohesiveness about the teamwork that exists when you do that. And that's one of the things that I've, you know, noticed from facilities that do this well, as far as workplace violence prevention and unit cohesiveness, those two things go together. And guess what? People want to pick up shifts there. People want to work together there because they help each other.
Exactly. And that's like so huge. I mean, I've even been as a patient seeing like a nurse practitioner in certain areas, like they were not very nice to me, even going to see a doctor. And I was like, and I try to like change up. I was like, okay, maybe I'll go in the morning because this person will be spry and cool, but so much just negativity and being nasty. And even I've worked at a few federally qualified clinics in, you know, lower socioeconomic areas, which I do enjoy working at because I find it very, very interesting, you know? But these doctors are like, oh, I'm just here to pay off my loans. And they're not very nice to the patients, you know?
And what happened was COVID hit, and all of the nurses that were trained during COVID did not learn any empathy. because we
I've seen a major shift
at least in the ICUs, because before it would be like at least the nurse would go in and like bathe their wash their hair or like
I used to always bathe and give massages after COVID anymore.
Like those nurses, there have been tons of patients that have never had a soap and water bath because they never knew that during like before COVID we used to like wash people's hair when they were
intubated.
Like, why would you spend the time in there to do that? I'm like, that's your job. Like, that's why we're here. Like, Epic and tasks lists and like making sure they live is like an added benefit of being enhanced. And like, that's the portion that's missing. Cause I can go into a room and with 20 seconds develop rapport with somebody because I know what to say and how to do it and how to make eye contact because I've been doing it for so long. And I know that if I spend that first 15 seconds getting to know you chit chatty, then the part where you're frustrated with me because the doctor didn't do something that they wanted done in a timely manner, I'm not going to be a target.
Sure. I read an article and this was before COVID. Because I was like, oh, storytelling would be great here. And a lot of these patients, a lot of these new nurses were like, my patient wants to talk to me forever. I mean, they didn't even know, they didn't understand that connecting with your patient and developing a rapport is so important. That's part of your job. I mean, I had a class in nursing school 100 years ago, and it was about active listening.
Right.
You know, you're there to just listen. And that is part of your job. And they don't, they're just like, oh,
and that's why I think
time
and
billing, it's not just tasks.
Right. Time and billing is really got to be updated with nursing because no one takes into account the time that it takes to be present with a patient. And that's really one of the key things about when we come in as consultants and do surveys is that if we don't have enough time and we can tie the time to retention and to metrics and feasible profitability scales, then we can prove that we should have a better staffing model. Going in and just saying like we have too many patients doesn't make sense to anybody.
And this is what we're hearing. This is the narrative. Staffing, not enough patients, nursing ratios. You know, there was one nurse I saw on TikTok. She's like, oh, I went in there and they had 8 patients for me and I just walked out and they called me the BRN on me because she like abandoned her patients. Yep. I was like, girl, you understand where you're going. You know how this place works. Call them before your shift and say, how many patients am I going to have? Who's going to be there? Or when you're there, go, okay, I need some resources. Who's available? Call the staffing office. Yeah. You know, or make yourself a leader. You don't just walk out. Like, what if you were a patient there and you heard this nurse just walked out? You know, I mean, I walked out of my clinic the other day, but it was because I had specifically said certain things needed to be done because I had an issue with someone who I was working with. And I go, I cannot work with this person anymore. She's unsafe. And I had written many emails to my medical director.
Because it causes liability on you.
Exactly. It was very, very scary. This person just shifted and I'd known her for a very long time. And I just was like, can't do this anymore. You know, I cannot baby her and coddle her. I'm scared now. You know, what's going to happen? And so when I went to work one day, she was there and I left and I called the guy and I was like, hey, we talked about this. And he's like, oh, she's not supposed to be there. You know? And I waited until she left. I go, I hope she understands that now she is creating a patient issue. Because it was all because she thought that it was okay and it wasn't a big deal. And I was like, no, she did massive stuff wrong. And it wasn't just a one day thing. I started to put this all together.
That's where we need to be like using our administrative resources, right? It's not for the lateral violence and the bullying that's going on, like where somebody makes you upset and hurts your feelings. So now you're reporting them to.
Yeah, that's not what it was about. No,
like, no, it's like if it's a care issue, if it's an actual issue, like that's when we go to management. That's it. Other than that, you're dealing with things interpersonally, professionally, and that just doesn't exist anymore in our profession. And that's something that, you know, when we go out and train and when I go out and speak to people, that's one of the things that I try to do. And that's something that I cover in that book that I'm going to be putting out.
That's awesome. And we'll talk about your book. One of the things, like, I remember working at a federally qualified clinic, and a couple of them this happened to. And one of the things with these federally qualified clinics is they have administrative staff who are not, don't have a healthcare background. Maybe this is their first job in healthcare, so they don't understand situations. Like, one time I had a patient, the mom was being very violent, you know, and she was being weird. And I said, well, I don't have to see this.
Pediatrics is a pretty dangerous place because of the emotions. You know?
Sure. And I go, and there was something going on where this mom didn't have custody of this kid, but the grandma did. And the grandma was waiting in the waiting room. I was like, no. I need to be in the room with the person who has custody, not the person who doesn't. And this mom started to get violent, so I refused to see her. Yeah. Well, the administrative secretary came in, and she was sleeping with the medical director, and she thought she could tell me what to do, and she threatened me. She's like, either you see this patient or you don't work anymore here. And I was on a locums assignment. So I was just like, are you kidding me? You know? And yeah, so she goes, like, well, I'll come in with you. Well, now you're just a secretary. Her HIPAA, and if you go and look at what the VRM says in California, you can't be there. You cannot be in the room. Like, she didn't even know that. That's how dumb she was. Another situation, I was working at another federally qualified clinic, and the manager worked at Subway before. Right. So I had, you know, something happened, and it was a foster mom, and she started screaming at me, and it looked like, and she lunged at me, and I lunged away, and I walked out of the room, and I said, I can't take care of you anymore. And I went to go tell him, and he's all like, oh, you just have to grow a thick skin. You have to deal with it.
Technically, per your Nursing Practice Act, and every nurse that's listening here, if you are not mentally, physically, or emotionally capable of caring for a patient and you assume care for them, that can be considered malpractice.
Right.
And if you have 5 other patients you're responsible for direct care, and you are hurt because of one patient, you're now responsible for the other 5. So this is why I tell people, like, make sure you read your state practice acts.
Exactly, it's so important.
You know, and now Texas legislation in SB 240 is supporting the idea that it is written into civil law now that as of September, I think they have to have everything in compliant by September 1st, that you have the option to have your assignment changed.
Threatened or
assaulted by a patient, but we don't have the staff to do that. So I don't know who wrote that or where they got that from, but okay.
Yeah. Well,
I have found a technology solution that'll help with it though. So it's good. I'm like finding, that's what I like to do, right? Is like, what is the complicated issue that nobody's talked about how to fix? And then let me find somebody who can fix it.
Your brain is so like mine. So tell us about your book.
So
it's perfect for Nurses Week that you're rolling it out.
As much as I really like talking to organizations and big, you know, and boards and consulting, obviously a lot of my knowledge is actual bedside application and what can we do to protect ourselves and our patients and each other while we're at the bedside. So I decided to do a clinical safety guide, and it really is just a handbook on what to do, what to look for, foundations of security. So you can even have a conversation with your security director about things in an intelligent way. They speak a different language, right? And a lot of the problems that I've seen with training that is developed for workplace violence prevention is that they're policing based, right? So as a police officer, they have a badge, they have a gun, they have a different, use of force continuum. They can actually put people in restraints or handcuffs. We can't do any of that kind of stuff, right? So our approach has to be much different. Plus we're 80, 90% female. So we need to have a completely different approach when we are looking at dealing with violence. And that is by having a high degree of soft skills. So some of the things in the book that I cover are like scene safety, like how to go into a scene and what to look for as part of your assessment and how to tie that into your nursing assessment. How do you document when a patient and what do you document? What is a behavioral anomaly? What do they look like? What are indicators for violence? You know, one of the things I say all the time is if a person is rolling their eyes at you, That is a behavioral anomaly. Unless I'm a 14-year-old girl and you just told me I couldn't go to prom. Like that is something that is a behavioral anomaly that is very often overlooked. If you are seen as an authority figure, someone should not be rolling their eyes at you. If they are rolling their eyes at you, that should count as number one. Then if you say, Mr. Jones, can you please tell me your date of birth? And they won't take the blanket over their head. You shouldn't walk over and just take the blanket down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for
sure. You
start
at the feet, maybe lift up, ask permission if they're not going to participate, and then you document it. You document, I observed three behavioral anomalies indicative of violence, or this patient has showed active or passive signs of violence. They're hitting, spitting, kicking. I will provide life-saving care only, especially if your policy and procedures and you don't have the right amount of resources in that organization. If right. you can't call security or get on the phone with a doctor or get what you need to take care of this patient appropriately and safely for yourself, then you should really consider having a conversation with your organization about the policies and procedures that support you and being able to write a note that states will provide life-saving care only. Because guess what? When they're coding, no one's going to
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. I love it. So do you also work with police departments? Like
I do.
We kind of talked about that study that's going on. I believe it's in Toronto, Canada, where they're sending out psych nurses with the police officers to deal with the homeless population.
Yeah, so mental health response is like a major part of this, right? Because when we're looking at gaps that whether it's the transient population and how are they cyclically returned to the streets without the resources that they need, or are we talking about mental undiagnosed mental health? Are we talking about behavioral health within school systems? But really the community is where we find these folks, right? So when I was looking at a way to help offload the burden into the healthcare organizations, I started looking at people in the UK because they have a better model for how they deal with these things because their right. system's just different. So I actually networked with Dean Malpass, and so he's an advisor there, and we came up with a model, and he's putting out a book and a model that make safe, make sense, make right. And it is a model that's designed for police officers and first responders to be able to identify mental health crisis in the field and then appropriately deal with it in their scope. Right. So now we have scope creep, right? So when that happens, it's like where things move into another zone where they're really not capable of taking care of things. And that's what happened in that event with me and the psych patient and the metal mop. It's nobody knew the rules and responsibilities. We didn't have the right policy and procedure, didn't have the right training, didn't have the right support. So it's a breakdown of that whole system. But that system starts with the police that picked up this guy on the street for, you know, unusual behavior and was brought in and dropped off. So how do we empower those folks to cops to stay out of court? Because ultimately, though, if he would have had a weapon or a gun, their goal is to neutralize that threat. And there have been many opportunities where officers, because of their mental health training and because of the litigation issues, they haven't neutralized the threat and someone's gotten hurt because they realize that they're a psych patient. So I think there's an opportunity there to be able to look at a very good comprehensive response, because the solution is not cost effective to take a nurse practitioner or a, you know, psych doctor and have them work as a beat cop. That's not the best way for that to go down. They have to have assessment criteria. They have to have right. length of time to treat the patient. Like that's not a comprehensive solution to this. It's a Band-Aid and it's an expensive one that right. we recommend, right? So how can we look for something where the cops can be cops, but also allow us to get the data that we need to make an informed decision before they even get to the ER? And can we standardize some of the verbiage with our training? So like, for instance, we're offering like mental health response workshops. So an organization like a police department, because they're struggling to make money too, right? So they can book us and then sell tickets for as many tickets as they want, and they can make revenue off of us coming to deliver this program. And then in September, we're having our first innovation and safety symposium, which is going to be focused on that mental health response unit and the recommendations. I'm going to the UK in June to study with some clients and look at their models and look at their policies and how they do things from a legislative approach all the way down to the actual bedside response, and then try and come up with some really good systems parallels. And we're using the Institute of Homeland Security. We've been endorsed by Law Enforcement Today for our police approach. We have a DDT model. And I think Dean has a book that's coming out soon on that too. So it's kind of neat because if we can get the verbiage together for them and then get the verbiage together for the nurses, then we can kind of collaborate and exchange information, and we can be able to push that data back to big organizations that are trying to give proof of help, right? If we have the data there that says there's this high volume of people that need a place to go and we need resources, then we can apply for federal grants and legislation to be able to provide those things.
I love that. I mean, here in Palm Springs, we're seeing more of a growing homeless issue, just like Los Angeles. Los Angeles is absolutely
bad here in Austin. It's really bad in Austin too.
So they had this police chief that they hired a couple of years ago. And so he was in Santa Cruz and then he was in Eureka as a police chief. And I did a deep dive on him because he's not a very nice guy. I mean, I had written the mayor lives in my neighborhood. So I wrote her some emails about certain situations going on because of Coachella and because of the festivals that come into town. We get a lot of traffic. Mm-hmm. So I started noticing that police officers are heavy for certain things, mm-hmm. and not so heavy for other things that really just involve the citizens who live here full time.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of people that come here recreationally and stuff. But I did a deep dive on him because I kept seeing, you know, they kept putting in so much money into the homeless population and, you know, homeless issue, and they built a shelter and stuff. But we have people just slain out on the sidewalks and just uncovered, just, you know, passed out in the bus stops and stuff. And it's like with him, he keeps saying the same thing. There's nothing we could do. There's nothing we could do. There's nothing we could do. And I was just like, no, that's not true.
You know? I think it is like, it's a funnel, right? Like it's just like lead generation in the business, right? There's business out here. We know that it's there, but how do we get it concentrated? And I think one of the first steps is looking at dispatch calls and looking at the calls that are coming in and figuring out classifying them, being able to look at trends. We can leverage technology, AI now, and do predictive analytics. So like to say that there's nothing that can be done is really naive now, so maybe we need to just be more creative in our approach. But I think ultimately, once we can get these people into the funnel and into resources where they can get help, then we can do that. But ultimately, we can't fix social construct problems and big, large, that takes a tremendous amount of funding and government support. But what I can do for officers and for sergeants and captains that have that same approach, you know, is to give them really great training to at least ensure that their cops can avoid liability when they can stay taking care of the things that they should be taking care of, and then passing it off. And, you know, in the UK, the police chiefs and the nursing organizations came together and wrote the letters to get the changes done from their government over there, because they came together as a combined unit saying, our departments are stressed, their inpatient departments are stressed, you guys need to come up with the funding to do something about this social problem that we have created because of inflation and all of the other reasons why people are substance abuse and opioids and all the other reasons why everyone's unable to function like a, you know, person that doesn't end up on the street.
For sure. So what's in the future for you then? You have your book.
Yes. Right now, just trying to get in front of as many boards as we can to make impactful change, each organization at a time, no matter how small, how big, has opportunity for improvement and to be a part of this. And then, you know, on a really global scale is creating that we're writing the first textbook for workplace violence.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So we've come together with a whole bunch of advisors across the world, and we'll be starting production on that. And that'll be available to university students, as well as, you know, future medical directors, future, you know, administrative people. But there'll be something in that textbook for everybody to be able to understand the climate of healthcare violence. We'll have case studies, we'll have recent research, and then, you know, obviously just growing our, we have a podcast too called Tactical Scrubs, where we share a lot
awesome.
Of
information.
So just growing that brand and being an available resource to nurses and doctors and healthcare workers and teachers in the school sector.
I love it. So where can people find you, Mel?
They can visit our website at cortexgold.com, or I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. Make sure you follow me on LinkedIn, and you know, we're here to help. I tell people all the time that my clients are anyone who cares.
And you're offering your book for $5.
$5. Yep. It's $5. It'll be available on sale next week for Nurses Week. And we have lots of other resources in our library, like That Make Sense, Make Safe, Make Right. And then Dean is writing this really cool mental health workbook, and it's like got each page has like a different diagnosis and
then awesome.
Symptoms, recommended medication treatments, like recommended therapies, like all in one page. And then it has like his top five triggers so that you can reduce, you know, violence. It's pretty cool. It's a really awesome. Neat. We just did panic disorder. I just looked at panic disorder the other day, and I was like, that's like every homeless person I've ever taken.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome. This has been an amazing conversation. I learned so much. I love it. Thank you for being on now.
I really appreciate it. What you're doing is awesome. And, you know, keep writing.
Same to you. Cool. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nurses and Hypochondriacs podcast. We'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. We'd also love a monetary donation. You can go ahead and donate on Venmo at nurses-hypo. Links are at the show notes. If you'd like to take any of the well-written nurse writing and storytelling classes, those links are also at the end of the show notes. And we'd love it if you come and learn the art of storytelling. Thanks again for listening. Till next time.